It is Thursday, April 17th, 2014. My name is Myla Cedar, and I am on vacation from elementary school. So I insisted my dad take time off to teach me how to use a chainsaw. So today, you are listening to the Best of the Majority Report.
All right, Myla, thank you very much. I'll take it from here. Hi, folks. I am on vacation, and so today we have a best of for you. Today we thought that we would play something from January 28th of last year, Arthur Goldwag on the right-wing conspiracy machine. And members, you'll get to hear from Martin Garbus, the famous First Amendment rights lawyer, on the John Roberts nomination back from 2004. We're going to look into what people are saying about John Roberts, particularly in light of all this campaign finance stuff that has come down between Citizens United and McCutcheon. So sit back and enjoy. I'll be back live on Wednesday of next week.
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Arthur Goldwag. He is the author of The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Popular Right. We will we have a link up at majority.fm to your book, which came out in 2012. I appreciate you joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, Arthur, there was a couple of things that I think, I mean, your book has obviously been fairly relevant for some time, from even prior to when you wrote it, frankly. But I am increasingly conscious of the tremendous amount of conspiracy theory that is driving the right and the sort of the I guess that's what you would call it, the popular right in this country. On top of which, West Point's Combating Terrorism Center came out with a report recently that said that violent attacks by right-wing groups and individuals have increased by 400% since 1990, and particularly a sharp increase in the number of victims between 07 and 2011, I should say, 2011. But let's start here at the beginning. You say it's the new hate. Is this a new hate that we're seeing on the right, or is it sort of a recycled hate?
It's recycled hate. I mean, my book has been relevant since about 1798 or even before that. 1798 is when we had the first panic about the Illuminatus in the United States. You know, the Illuminati doesn't start with Jay-Z. It goes back very far back in history. And it's a fear of a terrible conspiracy of a secret movement of people that want to take away what makes America America. And that's really what the question is what makes America America? And what the terrible thing about the Illuminati was that they were against kings and they were against the church. And of course America also begins as a country that was against kings and against the church. But once it becomes a country, there's, you know, a group of people that are worried about its revolutionary basis. And there's this kind of double quality with far right-wing thinking. On the one hand, they're always talking about tearing down the state, about blowing it up, about watering the tree of liberty. And on the other hand, you know, they're very authoritarian and they're worried about lawlessness. And it's a contradiction that produces a lot of crazy stuff. And we see it all the time. And what I say in my book is that you hear it sometimes between the lines, that there's an underlying narrative that ties a lot of discrete things together. And when you hear a mainstream politician talking sometimes, if it doesn't sound quite right, it's because there's a different story that he's telling under the surface.
Well, what is, I want to get to what is that main narrative. But, I mean, this is what's, you know, sort of fascinating about, for instance, the Illuminati, because it's still, you know, the Illuminati is one end of a spectrum that, you know, sort of goes through the Bilderberger group, I guess, and through, the Alex Jones, Glenn Beck, at least Glenn Beck a couple of weeks ago before he got into a fight with Alex Jones. But it's fascinating because the Illuminati, and I assume it's the same with these other conspiracies, is has a sort of a malleability as to the implications. I mean, like you say, you recount how it was a threat to the system of kings, but now in some ways it's sort of replaced it, in some ways, right? I mean, it seems to change. The implications of the Illuminati, for instance, seems to change with the times.
Well, you know, there's, when you talk about conspiracy theory, there's one document that is it is just so important, and it was deeply important to Hitler. It's been deeply important to the far right in this country, and that's the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a creation of the Tsar's secret police at the turn of the last century. And what it claims is that there has been a Jewish plot almost from, you know, for thousands of years, to take over the world, to install a Davidic king in Jerusalem and completely control the world through the power of money. Now, a lot of people, they're not anti-Semitic at all. They have Jewish friends and everything. I'm sure Glenn Beck considers himself a great friend of Israel. But the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is actually the script that he's reading from. He may not even know it himself, but the conservative narrative, narrative, the far right-wing narrative is that there's this looming threat, and this looming threat wants to take the Republic of the United States, take its sovereignty away. They want one world government, and this is in the last generation. It was communism, you know, one world communism, working through the UN, working through the Bilderberg Group. It was actually, you know, the argument was that the communists weren't just the workers' parties; it was also billionaires. And it was Rothschild bankers working with the communists to bring the United States and the whole world under the sway of one world government. 200 years ago, it was the Illuminati. Now people are worried about Sharia and the Arabs, but it's always this other. And when you steep yourself in right-wing conspiracy theory, you realize you're constantly reading the same story, whether it's the 1840s or the turn of the century, whether it's today. It's different actors. You could take a document from the 1890s and just replace the name Rothschild with George Soros, and you would have the same. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It's this fascinating phenomena. And I called it the new hate because it's just not the new hate. it's the old hate. It's the constant hate. It's the perpetual hate, the perennial hate.
Well, so
we're seeing. I'm sorry. Say what you were going to say.
Well, so what you're describing is no. What you're describing is, film students are told to always read the hero's journey. And that theoretically every film you could break down on this one sort of template, obviously, but the names change, the characters change, but there's always a threshold that they have to go to and some type of advisor that leads the hero through. So you're basically saying that the conspiracy theories that we have today, the template has been around forever in some respects. It's just that there are new sort of characters that are plugged in. In some instances, some of the characters remain the same, that are plugged in, and it generates essentially the same story template.
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's an archetype. It's an archetypal story, and when you there's this part of the archetype is that. The character discovers this, you know. Luke Skywalker learns about the Force, and he didn't know it, and he learns the whole story. And you know, there's always this moment, there's this aha moment in the conspiracy theory, where oh my God, it's the bankers, and the scales fall from their eyes, and everything falls into place. And if you listen to Alex Jones, I mean, that's what happens on Alex Jones' show every day. He says, let me tell you what's really happening. Let me tell you what's really happening. And what's happening is the world is about to come to an end. What's happening is everything you love is about to be taken away from you. And, you know, as complicated as politics are, as confusing and mysterious and terrible and unjust as the machinations of money go, you know, nobody understands high finance. So you need to know math. You need to be an insider. But the conspiracy theorist realizes that you don't need to know math at all. You just need to know the story of good and evil. You need to know, you know, there are bad people that are trying to destroy you. And with somebody like me, I'm not saying that there aren't conspiracies. I'm not saying that there aren't terrible crimes. You know, I have really serious politics. But what I'm saying is that life isn't a story like Star Wars. That, you know, that I'm very suspicious of people that tell me these great stories, these great narratives. Because life is really much more complicated than that. And, we're seeing this now with the shooting in Connecticut, Newtown. It took months, years, before the 9/11 truthers started to get their story heard in wider venues. And it happened largely through the internet and YouTube, and there were a couple of YouTube movies that got a lot of circulation. 9/11 was such a shock. It was just so astounding that people that we barely knew about could do so much damage to us. So people told a story about it. Well, actually, it wasn't people that we don't know about. It was the same people that have always been persecuting us. It was this cabal of bankers. It was billionaires and, you know, people from caves and Arabia working together with the same nefarious goals. And if you look deep into a lot of the 9/11 truth stuff, it ends up, you know, an awful lot of the people end up finally citing the protocols of the Elders of Zion. They may not know that they are even, but it's because they've been swept into this big story. And so with Newtown, Connecticut, you know, how could somebody do this to little children? Within just a couple of weeks, there's a whole body of conspiracy theory. It was Obama. He wants to take guns away. it was the Israelis. They're either working with Obama or they're working against Obama. It was one group or another group, but the point is you can understand it. The point is you go from having to deal with the terrible mystery to dealing with a powerful story that you know what it is, and it's like, you know, it's like your movie template. Once the audience picks up that they're seeing this archetypal story, they know that the hero has to fight, and that's kind of what the conspiracy theorist is telling you. You know, you're not at the mercy of terrible things. You know, conspiracy theorists will always tell you that they're terribly skeptical people. I think that they're, you know, among the most optimistic people in the world, because they believe that you can finally understand things.
Right. It's interesting because the Sandy Hook Newtown conspiracy theories, I mean, that have actually led to, you know, just basically people who were not involved but protected some kids. There was a story out a week or two ago about one of the guys who sort of helped some kids who showed up on his driveway after escaping the school, has been harassed because and accused of being some type of crisis actor or something, like literally a hired actor to present this story. I mean, it seems to me that in that instance, there's almost more of an agenda. I mean, because I understand, and this is why I find these people so dangerous. I'm talking more the purveyors of these conspiracies than the sort of the people who believe them. But I understand why, you know, that impetus, that desire to have complicated issues or issues that are hard to digest, that human desire to have them simplified and digestible in some way. There seems to me to be in the case of the shooting in Connecticut, a more powerful agenda, but maybe that's just a function of this cognitive dissonance. How can this happen? Well, of course, it didn't really happen. It is part of some other secret agenda, like you say, on the part of Obama. I mean, it just seems to me that this conspiracy industry is almost getting more aggressive in trying to answer every question out there with this sort of...
Well, the Connecticut case is a really good example because, you know, the anti-Israel conspiracy theories, we know where they started. They started in Iran at a propaganda station called the Press TV that broadcasts English language propaganda. That is actually the site where a lot of the anti-Israel stuff started. That got picked up by 9/11 people that I don't even know how much of an agenda they have. They're just into it. But then you get this, you know, the NRA. They have a real problem. They need cognitive dissonance because, you know, you have a woman who was a gun nut who had a lot of guns. She was a prepper, and her crazy son killed her and killed a bunch of school children. That seems on its face to be an argument for having background checks and you know, all sorts of gun restrictions and so on. So they have to turn the story upside down. And they have to say, you know, what happened here is, you know, someone tried to discredit preppers. Someone tried to discredit gun owners. Look how terrible these anti-gun people are. They're, you know, they're more dangerous than the gun people. So that they're using this, you know, this conspiracy theory that comes from Iran to discredit Israel, to discredit gun control. They're very cynical. You know, they don't like Iran, but they represent the gun industry, and they want to, you know, if you're going to look for a conspiracy, that's the kind of conspiracy that I see there, is people manufacturing cognitive dissonance for a very real agenda, not a crazy fantasy agenda, but an agenda that's about corporate power and money and all the things that we should be looking at.
And give me a sense of, I mean, let's talk about the sort of the agenda of people starting this. I mean, because, you know, What is behind? I mean, in some instances, yes, there is value for an organization like the NRA, which has been driving gun sales for years, based upon this notion that Obama was going to take away your guns, and on some level, sort of their own success caught up with them on some level, at least in terms of some type of reasonable gun control. What are there different categories of the people who spread these type of conspiracies? In other words, you know, when you run the gamut from the Alex Joneses and the WorldNet Dailies and the Glenn Becks to the NRA to the Ron Pauls, they've all capitalized on these conspiracies. It seems to me that there is a distinction, at least in terms of how direct that capitalization is. You know, Alex Jones capitalizes on it because he sells more whatever it is that he's selling. He's a bigger radio host, a video host. He's got documentaries on the real Obama or something like that. But is there like a spectrum there?
Absolutely. And again, I mean, Alex Jones, pretty much everything Alex Jones says comes out of the John Birch Society's Blue Book, which he read as a teenager, and it had a profound effect on him. He's talked about that. But he would say, you know, I'm not a John Bircher. I'm a libertarian. I'm an anarchist. I'm not partisan. I believe in freedom. I think he's gotten so, you know, his product is Alex Jones. He was selling conspiracies about Clinton. He was selling conspiracies about Bush. He's an opportunistic guy, but I think he genuinely believes this stuff. I think, you know, his creative method is he scares the shit out of himself, and then he goes on the radio and scares other people. He had this amazing moment in July of 2001 when he said, you know, there's going to be a Reichstag fire event so that they can take our guns away and so that they can declare martial law. Something terrible is going to happen any month now, just like it was when they blew up the World Trade Center. And boy, has he gotten a lot of mileage out of that. You know, he's like the stop clock that was right twice a day. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had been saying this for a long time. He didn't really predict 9/11. But he even, in that broadcast, he even said, you know, that they're going to blame it on bin Laden. He hit some real notes there. You get a character like Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck is another one. It's the John Birch Society. When he converted to Mormonism, he kind of fell under the spell of Clan Skousen, who was a very important figure. What they called it, the Church Birch Nexus. There were some very, very right-wing Mormons in the 60s that were involved with the John Birch Society and ultra-patriot movements. And Glenn Beck gets a lot of his stuff from there. But he's also, you know, he's got stuff that he's selling. And he's kind of a grandiose person. You know, he's selling the idea now of a Glenn Beck city that you can go live in that's dedicated to liberty and the gospel of Glenn Beck. He may actually be crazy, but he's a skillful purveyor of this stuff. The NRA, long before Newtown, it was back in 2011, I think, at the CPAC conference, Wayne LaPierre made a speech, and he said, you know, Obama has a huge conspiracy that he's a part of. He's going to not do anything about gun control. And this is a huge conspiracy so that you'll reelect him. And then as soon as you reelect him, he's going to take your guns away. And, you know, the Newtown incident, when it happened, the timing of it, it was, you know, a wonderful thing for Wayne LaPierre. It seemed to confirm his speech. And in the spectrum of conspiracy theory mongering, Wayne LaPierre scares me more than anybody else because he knows better. You know, he's really using it to because he's a because he runs a big lobby. He's really using it. A lot of the racist tropes that you heard throughout the primaries when the Republicans were fighting to show which one was the most conservative, and Newt Gingrich kept talking about the food stamp president and so on. You know, of course there's a lot of racism in this country, and of course a lot of the animus towards Obama is fueled by racism, but when mainstream politicians use that, when they use the dog whistles and the signals and so on, when they leverage the stupidity and the superstition and the fear of the public to get their agenda through, that's much more blameworthy than just being crazy or right. just being scared, and that's the kind of thing that concerns me the most.
When you see because over the past year we've seen three major shifts, it seems to me, or at least we hit the tipping point on three major issues: marriage equality, I think, in terms of women's right to choose, and now we're seeing it with gun control, where they have now become they're now perceived, at least by the center and the center left, to be winning political positions in a way that they haven't been in some instances ever, but certainly over the past 10-12 years. And demographically speaking, it seems like those changes are going to be locked in. In other words, you know, we're going to see Democrats run harder on a woman's right to choose, and we're going to see the marriage equality seems to be almost off the table at this point as a political issue going forward. I mean, at least in terms of national politics, or at least as them, you know. In 2004, it was a plan by Rove to help George Bush, and now that same plan in 2016 or 2012 is essentially would be like a suicide plan in terms of like mm-hmm. Republican aspirations. And now we see the numbers on gun control also change. What's going to happen? I mean, is it going? My sense is it's going to sort of create an even more pure and virulent strain of this conspiracy, but it's going to be more hermetically sealed, which is going to make it even resonate even more.
Well, you know, again, if you nothing's new, right? So if you go back, you know, we remember the Roosevelt years, the FDR years, as a time of one liberal triumph after another. Roosevelt got elected during this terrible depression. He brought Keynesian stimulus to bear on the economy. He used all these public works. He rescued the economy. He brought Social Security into being. But if you actually go back to the 30s and you look at what was going on, the left was perpetually disappointed with Roosevelt. He wasn't going far enough. And the right was virulent. And what they were more concerned about than just about anything was, you know, that Roosevelt seemed to want to fight the Jewish war in Europe. And they wanted to stay out of Europe. And they wanted to take back control of business. They thought he was socializing the country. I think we're going, you know, I think the culture is changing in ways that are as horrifying for the right now as they were back then, because, you know, demographically and culturally, they can't get it back. They can't get it back. We're an urban culture. We're a much more diverse culture, and the and we're not a gun culture. We're not a frontier culture anymore. But what scares me, I mean, I'm quite optimistic that we're going to be a more liberal, inclusive country in 50 years. I'm terrified that the right is going to be using all of the tools of propaganda and disinformation and the political tools of gerrymandering and vote rigging and so on to keep power. And so things could be very, very dangerous for the left in the near term for quite a while. Because we're doing so well, we're in such danger. And again, none of this is new.
Give me your sense. I'm going to ask you. I mean, give me your sense from a political standpoint, because my disappointments with the so-called left in this country is that in a popular economic sense, that it is very much adopted neoliberal policies, and I wonder if the what's happening socially. I mean, certainly President Obama, I think, has moved much further, maybe not in the speed that people had hoped, but he's moving much further on social issues to the left than he is in terms of economic issues. And maybe you disagree with that assessment, but I wonder if what is happening on the right then ultimately puts into play economic issues. I mean, once we have cleared the deck in some respects of social issues so that the center is holding on those, does it open up the question of a debate on economic issues?
Well, me on economic issues, I think that there's a huge thing going on that dwarfs of an enormity that dwarfs what the conspiracy theorists fantasize about. I mean, I think we have capitalism is so mature at this point that it's not going to grow anymore. I mean, I think the great capitalist motor of the developed world is profoundly broken. And I think that it's been really, really difficult for the president of the United States, whether he's a Democrat or a Republican, is not yet able to say that. And I don't know. I mean, I think the economic issues are so big, and the United States is in such we're losing our middle class, and the system is working the way it's supposed to work. It's producing a few very high-paying jobs, and a lot of low-paying jobs, and a lot of unemployment. And it's doing capitalism is designed to maximize returns, and that's how it works. And so capitalism is in a very unsustainable position, and I don't know what's going to happen with that.
Do you think that will get addressed more, or do you think that with what's happening in terms of the demographics and the sort of the move to the left, if you will, on social issues, that issue of the failure of capitalism to address what our society needs at this point is going to be addressed more, or are we going to see it in some way being obfuscated by these either the social issues or the sort of the conspiracies that are meant to address, are we going to see more, because to a certain extent, I've always said that, without Alex Jones saying that it's a function of, you know, some type of one world cabal, people, his listeners might actually have to say, like, hey, there's an aligned interest set, aligned interest amongst a certain group of people in society that is far broader than people who are, you know, dancing around a burning owl or whatever it is. This is really more of a class struggle than it is a secret cabal.
Well, you're right. I mean, I 100% agree with you. And again, if you go back in history, why did the Tsar's secret police come up with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion? Why did they create this document that was meant to turn people's attention to the Jews? Because they were trying to save the Tsar. You know, there was a socialist revolution going on that turned into a communist revolution, and this was one of their propaganda efforts to keep things the way they were. And one of the things that I see right now, you know, our system is failing. It's failing systemically, but at the same time that it's failing, it's treating one narrow sector of the population very well. And it's interesting because a lot of the people that are doing well by capitalism right now are not right-wingers. You know, a lot of the people that are doing the best economically are also very progressive people mm-hmm. politically. And but they're not prepared to look past the system as it exists now. And, you know, I don't think it's sustainable. And what I worry about is that you could really have, with the help of conspiracy theory and the help of an angry right, you could see a kind of corporate fascism. It's something I could really picture happening. On the other hand, you could see slowly... but maybe faster than you would think, in the way that, like, gay rights happen so much faster than you would have thought 10 years ago, you may start seeing this country looking more and more like European socialism. Because the cap, you know, no, it's not, it's, you know, as people say, you know, socialism isn't the motor for prosperity that capitalism is. But when you have, when you don't have a middle class anymore, you can't really talk about this great motor for prosperity. You know, it's not really the 1%, it's like the 20%. But it's not sustainable if it's just the 20% either. We're in trouble. And the other funny thing about all this conspiracy theory is that, like, if you listen to Alex Jones from an economics perspective, you know, he's just telling you this recycled crap from 100 years ago. There's potential for real downfall right now, and people aren't doing the analysis. So, yeah, I mean, it's we're at a hinge point. We don't know which way it's going to go, but we are really at a hinge point.
Well, that's a good point to end this conversation. Hopefully, hope springs eternal, I guess. Arthur Goldwag, author of The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Popular Right. Appreciate your time today. Interesting stuff.
Okay,
and we've got,
thank you.
We've got a link
to
your...
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We got a link on our blog at majority.fm to your work. Thanks again for joining us. Hey.